On the walk to the parking lot, the snow was more persistent.
That was pitiful, Rob said. Why don't we just tell them?
You don't know, even yet.
Sure I know. You tell people that something is going to invade not only their space but their actual personal bodies, they are going to panic. I'm panicked just thinking about it. If there was any viable alternative, I'd take it.
I think that's how we all feel. But our next step is to meet this family, because if we found this kid, we can be sure that Mike has found him, too.
Maybe the Greys will attack him.
If he showed up with a gun, they'd probably abduct him and barbecue his damned brain. But what if he's more indirect? They have their limits, Lauren, as you must know.
Look, I don't know how to protect him either, okay? And it's winter, it's snowing, and it's starting to get dark. So one of us had better come up with an idea. How about it, boss?
I'm not the boss. You're the one closest to the Greys. You're the boss.
Fine. I say we go out to Oak Road. Take it from there.
First they returned to Alfred. Rob threaded his way around to the parking lot closest to his billet and went up to change again. After Jeffers' reaction, he no longer felt that the uniform was such a good idea. She sat in the car and listened to the radio, which told the story of the onrushing storm.
23.
Hi, Chris, Caitlin said. She was quite surprised to see him. The Jeffers usually called before they came over. As he entered the foyer, snow swirled behind him and he brushed off his coat. He looked extremely solemn, she noticed. Are you okay?
Where's Connor?
Downstairs, designing a train wreck. He had an unpleasant day, apparently. Why do you ask?
We need to talk. Where's Dan?
Dan, Caitlin called. Chris is here.
Yo!
Hey there, he said, coming in from the kitchen.
What's up?
Then he saw Chris's face.
What's wrong?
They went into the family room together. The TV was blasting. Caitlin turned it off.
I got a classic visit from the Air Force today.
What was he talking about?
What visit?
You're not conversant in the UFO literature, of course. You've never read a word of anything I've given you.
That would be correct, Dan said.
I got a visit from the Air Force. He looked from one of them to the other. Caitlin had no idea what to say. She was at a complete loss.
All right, let me background you.
There is this legend that when somebody has a serious sighting or gets video or something like that, the Air Force secretly investigates. Do you follow that?
Yeah, Dan said. Of course.
Caitlin felt kind of queasy. She wasn't sure she wanted to hear this.
Okay, so, when I went back to my office after class, and who's there but this Air Force colonel and this woman? My God, this woman.
Not another one down, Caitlin thought.
Is Nancy at home? Is she aware of this woman?
Yes. She'll be over in a minute. The baby's going to sleep. But I didn't want to wait, and you'll see why in a second. Just listen.
Okay, so I come in, and the colonel is looking at UFOs in the national security state, which I believe I foisted off on you last summer.
Okay, Dan said. Ended up on the shelf with Trailer Park Ghosts and Bigfoot, First American, I'm afraid.
Chris's voice had a curious measured quality to it, so different from his normal tone that Caitlin felt a twinge of concern that he might be sort of crazy just at the moment. She did not want him to be crazy here. She and Dan were trying to work their way past the Marcy incident and having trouble. She wanted to let him make love to her, but so far had been unable. Unable just a couple of hours ago.
Anyway, I have a prediction. These two folks are going to show up right here at this house sometime very soon, and they are going to ask to meet Connor.
That focused Caitlin at once. That'll be the day, she said.
This man is this very big, tough-looking type, but fatherly, sort of.
You know this guy is in on the secrets the second you lay eyes on him. Very imposing figure indeed.
The woman? Well, you have to see her. She radiates something, and it is weird. If I ever saw anyone who might be an alien in human form, it's this woman. She has these big staring eyes, and she is very, very still. She just sits there staring at you, and you get these bizarre feelings, like she's penetrating your mind somehow.
This was all beginning to sound more than a little crazy, even for Chris.
You're scared, she said. Tell us why.
I didn't realize at first what's going on, and I slipped. I told them something I don't think I should have.
about Connor being a genius.
But they were there asking about the UFO, Dan said. So what does it matter?
Oh, no. They never mentioned the UFO, of course not. That isn't the way these things are done. They were asking if we had any physics geniuses at Bell for some kind of Air Force program.
Caitlin laughed. She couldn't help it. He glared at her, though, and she stopped.
I've had enough laughter, he said in a low voice. The point is, they didn't actually mention UFOs, though?
No, Caitlin, they did not.
The phone rang. Caitlin got up and took it in the kitchen.
Hi, Nancy.
It's snowing too hard. I'm staying put. Has he told you?
Nancy asked.
He thinks the Air Force is interested in Connor because of the UFO. He's not making a lot of sense, Nancy.
She did not tell her that he sounded like he was on his way around the bend, not with a little baby for her to worry about. Anyway, he'd probably be fine in the morning. He had these flights of weirdness every time a big UFO report appeared on one of the crazy person websites he haunted.
The reality part is that the Air Force is looking for geniuses for some sort of program of theirs, Nancy said. The crisp part is that they're secretly investigating UFOs.
Well, then I'm glad he told them about Connor. Connor could use more stimulation.
Be careful, Caitlin. This is some kind of military thing. I'd make certain that you can supervise Connor at all times.
Caitlin had no real problem with the military. But then again, she would protect Connor and Connor's mind from any kind of intrusion at all.
For sure, she said.
Is Chris drinking, by the way?
No, he didn't ask and I didn't offer.
Dan got tanked at the peep the other day and I loaded the liquor into the garage attic.
Over the Marcy thing, yeah, I heard.
God, this was such a little place.
You mean the fact that he got tenure?
There was the briefest of silences, then Nancy said,
Congratulations, by the way.
We're holding off on the official celebration until after the official announcement. You want me to send yours home?
Yeah, please.
Before the UFOs come out. She went back into the living room where Dan and Chris were staring at each other like two people at a funeral.
Mama called, Chris. Time to go home.
Caitlin, Dan said, I'm what they call an abductee, and so are you.
She sat down.
That again?
Okay, Dan, it has to do with folklore, not with reality. There's nobody being abducted by aliens because there are no aliens, at least not here at the moment. I'll grant that the video is strange, but we are in no way involved.
The doorbell rang and sent a shock through her. Silence fell. Dan jumped to his feet, strode off to answer it.
Caitlin brushed past him.
I'll get it.
She swung the door open.
A quarter of a mile away, Mike Wilkes crouched, watching the Kelton house. He was freezing cold, despite the fact that he'd bought boots, gloves, and a Black Eddie Bauer jacket. He knew the house's layout, and by nine he also knew that the boys both slept in the same room, that the dog was a Doberman, and that nobody in the house was in good enough condition to match him, despite the boys' age advantages. Lights flickering drew his gaze to the road. A car came, moving slowly in the snow. He slid back a little, lest the lights reflect on the lenses of his tiny light-amplifying binoculars. He did not recognize the vehicle, but he could see two dim figures inside. The lights went out abruptly, and he was sure that it had stopped around the bend. That would mean that it was either at the Jeffers or the Callahan's house. That was of interest, and he had to find out. He left his position but remained behind the tree line as he worked his way to a location that would enable him to see the last two houses on the road. Overhead, the three thieves saw the radiant energies of all the bodies on Oak Road. Given the alteration of the deadly satellite's orbit, they were on full alert now. Below them, they observed the shimmering darkness that was Colonel Wilkes moving among the trees. The thieves were uneasy about Wilkes being out here, but he showed no interest in the Callahan house. The collective had instructed them to let him proceed as long as he didn't threaten Connor directly. In fact, it was eager for him to proceed. Maybe he had bought their little trick. Mike returned to his original position. He had wanted to see if it was a motor pool car. It was not. Not only that, it was in front of the Jeffers house. His conclusion: continue with his plan. Caitlin was thunderstruck to see the very people that Chris was talking about standing on her stoop. They were snowblown and miserable-looking, and she immediately let them in. In the family room, Chris, smiling tightly, introduced them. He was at least partly right about the appearance of the glass woman. She had huge eyes, but they worked well in her face. She was a beautiful woman, and Caitlin knew instantly that her friend Colonel Langford was head over heels in love with her. Was she weird? Not at all. They began a spiel about a special Air Force program for the very brilliant. "Now," Caitlin said, "let me get this straight. You put Connor in this tutorial program, but he does or doesn't have to commit to the Air Force Academy."
"Oh, no," Miss Glass said. "No commitment at all. What will happen is that I'll visit Connor daily and work with him in these accelerated concepts we've been referring to."
"And back we go," Dan said, "around the circle again. Let me be blunt. We want in writing an exact description of what you intend to do with Connor, and we want to be physically present at all times when you are with him."
"And why don't you just tell the truth about this?" Chris said.
Lauren Glass turned to him, and for an instant Caitlin saw a flicker in her eyes that was most definitely not normal. Caitlin thought she knew why. This girl was also super bright. There is an aura around such people. They are not the same as the rest of us. "The truth is that we're in trouble with some important classified problems, and the country needs its very best minds to work on them."
"Is it weapons?" Dan asked.
"Sir," Colonel Langford said, "I can only repeat that we cannot go into detail."
"Not with us," Caitlin said, "but with our 11-year-old son, I don't think so."
"Yes," Chris said. "Way to go."
Caitlin watched Lauren Glass grow very still, then saw her lips go into a line and her face become pale. The big eyes glittered with suppressed rage.
"Folks, I'm sorry, but I think we're ready for you to leave," Dan said, "because I think that you're here because of that UFO and aliens and abduction and all that sort of thing, and the fact that you're trying to involve our son just plain scares me."
"Me too," Caitlin said. She stood up. "So let's just call it a night, shall we? And don't come near our son, because if we find out you're trying to approach him, we're going to report you to the police."
They gave each other frantic glances.
"Ma'am, sir, we can talk to him. We can approach him. We have the right."
"Okay, that's it," Dan said. He went out across the hall and upstairs, and Caitlin suddenly knew what he was doing.
"Dan!"
"Ma'am, your son is the most intelligent human being presently alive," Lauren Glass babbled. "Please listen to us, because I am uniquely capable of teaching him what he needs to learn."
Dan came rushing back with his hand thrust in his pocket.
"My gun is bigger than your gun," Colonel Langford said with frightening nonchalance. "I want to see that thing on this table right now."
He pointed at the coffee table.
"Right now, Dan. Do it."
Dan took the pistol out and put it on the table.
"You're right," Langford continued. "This does have to do with certain extraordinary secrets."
"At last," Chris said. "I remember me and Caitlin being brought together when we were kids, being brought together in this dark, womb-like place, and I think you might know something about what this was."
"I have some odd memories, too," Caitlin said, "but nothing..."
She trailed off. She didn't know what more to say.
"We believe that you were abducted together, so that by a process we don't understand, you would inevitably later marry and have Connor."
Caitlin's mouth was so dry that she could hardly speak. She didn't remember anything about any aliens when she was a kid, and she hadn't even known Dan back in Madison. But she had gone from being furious at these people and scared because they were obviously a couple of stinking liars, to a sort of nauseated dread. From the dark, in other words, to the very dark.
"And Connor is the smartest person in the world," she said.
"There could be others, of course, but he must be among no more than a very, very few. Certainly in this country, yes."
"That part doesn't surprise me. But as far as me and Dan, I met Dan years after we lived in Madison, so that's all conjecture."
Again, Lauren Glass smiled. She was a person with a thousand different faces, it seemed to Caitlin. This one combined what appeared to be contempt with anger, thinly masked beneath the grin.
and the more you looked at her eyes, the odder they got.
Connor is a staggeringly good physics student, Chris said. He's doing advanced graduate-level physics at the college, and his work is, well, beautiful. The grasp of math is a lovely thing to witness.
Langford spoke, his voice dense with authority. Dr. and Mrs. Callahan, what has happened here is that your child is intended to be the point of contact between mankind and a very old, very brilliant, and very advanced galactic civilization.
Caitlin felt suddenly horribly dizzy. Then a sort of bomb seemed to go off within her. Did this mean that Chris's nonsense wasn't?
Something came rising up from deep within her that seemed like a kind of release, as if some part of her had been in a trap and was now free. To her own amazement, she reached up so quickly that she didn't have a chance to check herself and slapped the colonel across the face. Nobody said a word. Then Dan began to shake. For an instant, it seemed as if he was having a full-bore seizure, but it emerged into silent laughter. His eyes were closed tight, tears filling them. Lauren Glass had cried out softly when the slap had taken place. Now she sat still and silent, rigid in her chair. Rubbing his cheek, the colonel said, "It's an understandable reaction."
"I'm sorry, I just... Dan, will you stop that?"
He took a deep breath. Another.
"What do we do?"
"What do you do?"
"With our little boy.
Who is he?
Who are we?"
"Let me give you a piece of advice," Langford said. "You just take things as they come. Don't worry about anything happening to your boy. He's well protected."
"He needs to be protected?" Caitlin asked.
But then it seemed a rather obvious question. Of course he needed to be protected, and so did his secret.
"I don't want anybody told this."
"Oh no, not at all. We try to avoid telling even you."
"This should be public knowledge. It's immoral to hide it." Chris's face was alight with zeal and excitement. Caitlin had a sudden chilling thought that he might go on TV with that stupid video the Keltons had made.
"Connor's life probably depends on hiding it," she told him. "Think about it. Think how many different fanatic groups would want him dead. How many governments would fear his power."
"I hadn't considered that." "Announcing the most amazing railway accident in the history of this or any other century."
There stood Connor, his shirt smeared with model paint and his tattered engineer's cap on the back of his head. He glared at them.
"Doom on the railways. Come and see."
Then he saw the two strangers.
"Oh, I'm so sorry."
He came into the room.
"This is our son Connor," Dan said. "This is, Mr. Langford and Miss Glass. They're from the,
we're from St. Francis Parish, Connor," Colonel Langford said, "soliciting for a fund drive."
"I don't guess this is the right moment for a train wreck, then. It's quite amazing, though."
"Connor has a train set," Dan explained to the two wondering faces. "He often builds staged railroad accidents."
"I guess Catholics wouldn't approve somehow," he said. "We don't actually go to church, or, oops, perhaps."
"We know that, Connor."
Connor took a step back. He had noticed a sense of winter that clung to them both. They were not pleasant people to be around. But all suspicions immediately dropped away when the colonel said,
"We'd love to see the train wreck."
"Great. I've been working very hard.
Connor, did you do my homework?"
Chris asked as the adults followed him down into his basement room.
"Absolument," he said. "I've got a new way of integrating the calculus, boyo."
"What are you talking about?"
"I have no idea. Look at it and see if it flies."
He crossed his room, picked up a badly tattered notebook, and thrust it into Chris's hands.
"And now, may I present the wreck of old 97.
He looked up at Lauren.
"It's a metaphor," he said, "of my day."
"Connor, this is beautiful," she said, looking over the train board. "Oh my God, Rob, look at this. Look at the detail."
"Glad you like it," Connor said.
There was something in his voice that Caitlin knew well. These two were going to get a surprise. Outside, Mike Wilkes had been forced to return to his car, which was hidden about a quarter of a mile away. The snow was getting more persistent,
and he couldn't risk it becoming immobilized. He had processed a few of the kids in the town, but he needed the night to finish his work. He wished the damn Keltons would go to sleep. He pulled the car out into the road and drove it for a distance in the giving snow, getting it onto the crown of the road. There would be no plow through here tonight. He decided that he had about an hour. After that, he was going to be forced to abandon this part of the plan. Not good. Possibly even fatal. While the collective worried about the president, the three thieves worried about the fact that Wilkes was still close to Connor. Adam was with them as well, preparing himself for what would happen tonight. He detected a familiar voice. Lauren was nearby. He shifted his interest away from Wilkes. The collective wanted to let him make his mistake, and that seemed a good idea. But Adam needed Lauren away from here, too, and soon. What was to be done required absolute privacy. He sailed across the snowy fields and into the yard behind the Callahan's house. There he built a vivid picture of Lauren's car being covered with snow. He sent this like a drift of smoke into her mind. As the train moved around the tracks, Connor made sound effects, screeching and huffing. Then he touched an edge of track, which sprung open. "It broke!" Lauren shouted. The next instant, the wonderful black and brass steam engine spewing smoke struck the sprung track and bounded off the superbly modeled little town. It churned down the main street, crashing into stores, snapping light poles and sending figures flying. "Wow!" Rob said into the silence that followed this remarkably realistic effect. "Why did you do this?" Lauren asked the boy. "So I can build it up again, in a new way. Hey, I just got this flash. Are you people going to want to get back to town tonight?" "Well, yes, we live in town." "Then I see in my mind's eye your car getting slowly buried. Or actually, quickly." Thoughts had to be pushed into Lauren's mind, but the child just sucked them up. Adam regarded him, a smiling, strutting little thing, the aura around his body vastly more complex and colorful than those around the others. Adam prepared to die. 24. Connor woke up and realized instantly that he was not in bed. He could hear wind and he seemed to be standing. He opened his eyes, white flying dots, cold. A leathery thing beside him. This was all impossible, so he closed them again. He opened them for just a second, saw darkness and millions of white dots, and closed them again, tight. He surveyed his situation. The strange church people had left. He'd gone to bed in his upstairs room. Mom had come in and stared at him, and gone all eerie. She'd cried for no apparent reason, and Dan had come and they'd hugged each other, then gone across the hall to their room. Sometime after that, he'd fallen asleep. Without opening his eyes again, he tried to decide what was happening to him now. Then he knew. He was going down the street in the snow, but he wasn't walking. He was sort of flying, which couldn't be real. Therefore, he was asleep. Again, he opened his eyes. He could see the house, which was drifting back behind him. This looked like a dream and felt like a dream, but it sounded and smelled like the real world. Perplexing, in other words. Not a dream, yet not possible. For a second he thought he heard the living room clock chiming, but it was the wind clattering pine branches in Lost Land, which was what he had named the big woods across the street. The woods were drifting closer, home farther away. There were three big leathery heads bobbing along around him. He gasped, started to scream, then forced himself back under control. He had to stay calm. This was contact. It had to be handled with all the skill and intelligence he possessed. "You're up to this," he told himself. But he was being taken. Okay, this was bad. He was being kidnapped by these guys, no question, no way to get around it. Is kidnapping ever good? If you're going to be straight, why not just ring the doorbell? He realized that he was hearing something odd in his left ear, a sort of deep whine, if such a sound could exist. He reached up and touched an earbud. Then he saw that one of the big-headed creatures had an MP3 player. There was no music coming out, though. Just this odd noise. He ripped the earbud out and immediately fell down in a big puff of snow. For a second he lay trying to understand just how this worked. It was sound that had caused him to defy gravity. Okay, there had to be some kind of harmonic. Or no, was he crazy? He'd figure the damn thing out later. The creatures swirled around with their mouths open and their hands on their cheeks. They were not menacing-looking, in fact, far from it. They looked scared, too. Then one of them thrust the earbud at him, not toward his ear, but toward his hand. He looked down at it. They hovered and wobbled their heads. "Please," came a sort of nice-sounding voice, the same one he'd heard in his head during the encounter with Pauly. No, it wasn't on, not out in the woods with no explanation. He ran back toward the house as fast as he could go. "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" "He's not screaming, you fool. He's running." He ran faster, his legs pumping. "Dad, Mom, help me, help me." The creatures buzzed around him like giant flies. The one with the earbud buzzed along ahead of him, face to face, holding out the earbud. The house was farther away than he thought. It was hard to make progress in the snow. Then the creature made a sort of thrust at his head. "Sorry, sorry, sorry." The earbud was in again, and he was all of a sudden running in midair. He yanked it out and hit the ground and got up and ran again, his feet crunching in the snow. He got to the front walk, vaulted the gate, landed in the snow, fell and got up, then slipped on the icy stones and fell harder, rolling off into the drift-choked front yard. He went slipping and sliding up the walk, his feet stinging from the cold. He reached the door, pulled on the handle. Locked. He rattled it. "Mom! Dad!" He dragged at it. "Oh, please, please!" He saw the doorbell under its little light and moved to press it. "We have to. We can't. Connor, come on. Go in him, you idiot. Now!" Connor then felt something that few human beings have ever felt. He experienced the sense of something moving inside his own body, slithering up from his gut, as if alive. Of course, the three thieves could have turned him off with a little whiff of gas and taken him wherever they cared to take him, but that was not what this was about. The collective had known that Connor would need to be tamed. Horrified at what he was feeling, Connor looked down at himself. His chest and belly were visible, his pajama top having blown open in the wind. Something glowed through his skin, and it was coming up from his chest toward his head. Bright light shone out of his body in the shape of the thing, a snake that twisted and turned inside. He cried out, he clutched at his chest, and the thing shot into his head, and the cry was stifled. His head glowed for an instant so brightly that the whole front yard was lit up. The icicles on the windows reflected blue light brighter than a flashbulb. Then it was dark. Real dark. Because Connor was not anywhere anymore. He was not looking out of his eyes, it didn't feel like. What it felt like was so odd that he could hardly believe it, but the truth was that he seemed to have been swallowed by his body, as if he'd gone down into his own stomach. This was all so totally new that he could not even think about it, let alone explain it. In truth, he was being affected by a simple electromagnetic field that was being applied with great care to about 2 million specific neurons in his brain. It wasn't magic. There is no magic. There is only the unknown. In this case, a very old and experienced science possessed of a great knowledge of how bodies and brains work. Objectively, he recognized that it must be some sort of illusion. Even so, the fear was a claw clutching his heart. He felt his body turn and begin to move away from the house. No amount of effort would get him back into his head or enable him to regain control of his movements. He tried to call to Dad, then, in his rising panic, to the police. Nothing worked. He could not make his voice turn on. Despairing now, he thought of how very, very sad his parents were going to be, never knowing what happened to him like this. "Somebody help me, please, somebody." "We are helping you." He felt himself turn, felt his feet dip into the snow, felt it blow against his chest. "Now I will remove myself from you," the voice said. "Do not run again." In a moment, he began to go up through his body. In another moment, he was seeing through his eyes again. The wind blew, the pines moaned, snow flew.
He had been taken deep into lost land, so deep that there was nothing around them but pines. No lights, no houses, just the pale glow of the snow. "We're the three thieves, but we didn't steal you." "Yes, we did. Shut up." "Okay, I hear you." Nobody moved. He was well aware of the mystery he was facing. Remarkable indeed. Then he saw movement in the woods, and a fourth gray appeared. He was not squat and kludgy like these three. He strode on long legs, and his head was more in proportion. Coming through the snow, he was as graceful as a dancer. He stopped behind the three and raised a long, thin arm, sort of like an Indian chief or something. Connor noted, no muscles. Therefore, the skin itself must contain millions of micro-muscles. He took a step toward them. Connor took a step back. He came closer. Connor yelled as loud as he could, get away from me! Then he clapped his hands over his mouth, actually surprised at himself. But there was more than one Connor in here, and the other one, the little child alone in the woods, was still really, really scared and did not care about the fact that this was contact. It was historical and damn awesome that it was him doing it or any of that. The other Connor took over and ran. He just ran. He didn't care where, deeper into lost land, past the great frowning trees, into the tangled places where nobody ever went. The more he ran, the more the panicked Connor replaced the curious Connor, and the wild and more frantic his flight became. Soon he began to feel his feet burning. He was getting cold. When he wasn't around the grays, he needed more than just pajamas out in this blizzard. Something they did had been keeping him warm. Curious, Connor thought. Heat without radiance or forced air or anything. I wonder how they do that. And he slowed down a little. Now his breath was coming out in huge puffs, and his feet were really burning, and it was meat locker cold. Sobbing like an infant, he stumbled to a halt. He forced the tears down, and finally stood trembling from the cold, rubbing his shoulders. The wind roared in the trees, and a big gust stung him head to toe with snow. Cold. This cold felt just like being burned, and he screamed into its howl, but his loudest cry was so small against it that he could hardly hear it himself. This was idiotic. He was here to think, not cry like some idiot. So, okay, he turned around and around, trying to get his bearings. No bearings. He hopped from foot to foot to keep the agony down, but it didn't work. He was barefoot in the snow in the middle of a blizzard and wearing cotton pajamas. He was quite familiar with the dangers of hypothermia. If he'd known the temperature, he could probably have calculated to the second just how long before he lost so much reason that he could no longer hope to survive. He had never thought much about dying before, but he thought about it now because it appeared that it was going to happen to him. He was already getting numb, and that was a really bad sign. It was a sign of death coming, he knew that. The next step was the final sleep. "Dad? Mom? Hey, I'm lost out here. Hey! Hey!" Ridiculous, meaningless effort. "Grays? Hey, I'm here. I'm willing to negotiate. Hey!" Nothing.